This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is Haru. I will be reading the business section of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Sunday, April 28, 2024. I will read the following business articles, time permitting. First article is from Allworth Advice, titled, "We're Not Married, What That Means for Our Money." That's by Amy Wagner and Steve Harubi of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Second article, Prime Energy sports drinks contain PFAS and excessive caffeine, class action suit says. That's by Jonathan Limehouse of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Third article, Kroger and Albertsons agree to sell all 579 stores in bid to save merger. That's by Alexander Coolidge of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Fourth article, popular brunch spot Sleepy Bee Cafe to shut down College Hill location. That's by B.B. Hodges of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Fifth article, Cincinnati and NKY Joann stores will remain open after company files for bankruptcy. That's by Amanda Garrett of the Akron Beacon Journal. Fifth article, Ohio Supreme Court brings down curtain on COVID death data. And that's by Strictly Legal's Jack Greiner of the Cincinnati Enquirer. And I'll begin with today's cover story titled, Raise a Glass to the Ohio Craft Breweries, Among the Top 50 in the United States. And that's by Chad Murphy of the Columbus Dispatch. The weather's warming up, and for some, there's nothing better on a hot day than a cold beer. And if you're an Ohioan who enjoys a good craft beer, we have good news. Three Ohio breweries are some of the best in the nation at producing at a high volume. Great Lakes Brewing Company in Cleveland, Rheingeist Brewing in Cincinnati, and BrewDog Brewing Company in Canal, Winchester, are among the top 50 U.S. craft brewing companies according to the Brewers Association. The association, which represents small and independent American craft brewers, released its annual report on the U.S. craft beer industry for 2023. As part of that report, the association lists the top 50 craft breweries and overall breweries in the country in terms of beer production based on sales volume. In Ohio, Great Lakes comes in at number 17 for craft breweries and 27 overall. Rheingeist is number 22 for craft breweries and number 32 overall. And BrewDog is number 36 for craft breweries and number 46 overall. Of the top 50 for 2023, 40 were small and independent craft brewers, according to the association. D.G. Yingling and Son, Inc. of Pottsville, Pennsylvania, makers of Yingling beers, was number one, followed by the Boston Beer Company, makers of Samuel Adams beers. About Great Lakes Brewing Company. Great Lakes Brewing bills itself as Ohio's original craft brewery, according to its website. Founded in 1988, the brewery distributes to 14 states and the District of Columbia and offers year-round staples such as Dorfmunder Gold Lager and Hazelcraft IPA, as well as seasonal beers like Oktoberfest and Christmas Ale. Cleveland.com calls Christmas Ale a cult favorite for Great Lakes, which turns its annual release into an event, the First Pour, and that pour is spelled P-O-U-R. About Rheingeist Brewing. Rheingeist opened in 2013, according to its website, and has grown since. It opened a second location in Camp Washington and has expanded its distribution to several states, most recently Michigan. The brewery's year-round selection of beers include Truth IPA, Cincinnati Light Lager, and Beer for Humans Easy Hop Ale. Its seasonal release include Crumb Cake Imperial Red Ale, Hustle IPA, and Franz Oktoberfest. Beer for Humans is the face of Rheingeist's charitable giving program. The brewery gives to about 300 organizations through Beer for Humans pint nights, in-kind donations, volunteer hours, emergency relief, DEI initiatives, event partnerships, and local membership engagement, according to its website. About BrewDog Brewing Company. Founded in Scotland in 2007, BrewDog operates 9 bars in the U.S., including several in the Columbus area, along with locations in Cincinnati and Cleveland, Ohio, and outposts in Atlanta, Las Vegas, and Denver. Those are among 100 BrewDog bars and 4 breweries worldwide, according to its website. It also has a hotel, the Doghouse Columbus Hotel, at its brewery in Canal Winchester. Its beers range from IPAs like Elvis Juice and Punk IPA to stouts and non-alcoholic varieties. The Brewers Association report on the craft beer industry. The number of craft breweries grew in 2023, hitting an all-time high of 9,761, according to the Brewers Association. Last year, 495 breweries opened and 418 closed. Craft brewers employed 191,421 people in 2023, a 1.1% increase from 2022. Small and independent brewers produced a total of 23.4 million barrels of beer in 2023, a decline of 1% from 2022. The overall beer market shrank 5.1% by volume in 2023, according to the association. Retail dollar value was estimated at $28.9 billion, representing 24.7% market share and 3% growth over a comparable value in 2022. The top 10 craft and overall breweries in the United States. These are the top 10 craft breweries in the country based on production level as rated by the Brewers Association. 1. D.G. Yuengling and Son, Inc. 2. Boston Beer Company. 3. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. 4. Duvel Mortgat, USA. 5. Gambinus. 6. Tilray Brew Brands. 7. Artisanal Brewing Ventures. 8. Brooklyn Brewery. 9. Monster Brewing. 10. Athletic Brewing Company. The top 10 overall breweries are 1. Anheuser-Busch, Inc. 2. Molson Coors. 3. Constellation. 4. Heineken USA. 5. Pabst Brewing Company. 6. Diego. 7. D.G. Yuengling and Son, Inc. 8. FIFCO USA. 9. Curran Lion. And 10. Boston Beer Company. Our next article is titled, We're Not Married, What That Means for Our Money. And that's by Amy Wagner and Steve Harubi of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Every week, Allworth Financial's Amy Wagner and Steve Harubi, CFP, answer your questions. If you, a friend, or someone in your family has a money issue or problem, feel free to send those questions to yourmoney@enquirer.com. My first question comes from JK and LD in Loveland. We're both in our 60s and previously divorced. We just started living together. And while we're in a committed relationship, we probably won't get married. Been there, done that. Is there anything we should know or do from a financial and legal standpoint since we're not legally married? Answer. Right off the bat, we need to remind you that we are not lawyers, so we can't provide legal advice. But we have a few general things you should keep in mind as a cohabiting couple. Something that can often get overlooked when relationship statuses change or beneficiaries on financial accounts. So update these ASAP. Beneficiaries supersede anything stated in a will, so they're extremely important to keep up to date. You likely don't want your ex-spouses receiving the inheritance, right? And yes, we've seen this happen. Similarly, you'll also want to create durable powers of attorney for health and finances as well. This will give each of you a legal say if the other becomes unable to speak for themselves or make decisions. Also keep in mind that when it comes to Social Security, cohabitating couples like yourselves will not be able to claim benefits based on the other partner's work record like married couples can do. And if you happen to break up, claiming the ex-spousal benefit off your respective work records is off the table as well, since again, you're not technically spouses in the eyes of the government. We should also note that inheriting an IRA is a bit more complicated for non-spouses, since all funds need to be drawn down within 10 years. This could have implications across other financial aspects of the surviving partner's life, such as taxes. Additionally, while you are allowed to set up a joint bank account together, putting in too much over a certain threshold could mean you have to file gift tax return. If you own a home or plan on buying one, you'll also have to think about how the house is titled, who's on the mortgage, how will the expenses be split. You could consider creating a cohabitation agreement to help with these kinds of questions, among others. But again, please consult a lawyer. With all that in mind, here's the Allworth advice. One of the keys to any relationship is being open and honest about money and financial goals. And this doesn't change depending on whether or not you have a marriage certificate. So be sure to continuously have these kinds of heart-to-heart talks. Our next question comes from Cleves, from Judy. I started claiming Social Security at 62, but now want to stop. Can I do that? Answer. These are two courses of action here. There are two courses of action here. You can suspend your benefit or you can withdraw your benefit. Withdrawing your benefit is basically like asking for a mulligan. It's a one-time action. You can take it if it's been less than 12 months since you were first entitled to benefits. You'll have to repay any benefits you have already received. Meanwhile, suspending your benefit is more of a pause. In this case, you can actually earn delayed retirement credits for each month your benefit is suspended, which will boost your benefit down the road. But you have to be at least full retirement age and younger than 70 to do this. The Allworth advice is that Social Security is one of the more complex parts of the retirement planning. Just one decision could have reverberating effects for years to come. A fiduciary financial advisor can help you determine which of these options is truly the best course of action. The responses are for informational purposes only, and individuals should consider whether any general recommendation in these responses are suitable for their particular circumstances based on investment objectives, financial situation, and needs. To the extent that a reader has any questions regarding the applicability of any specific issue discussed above to his or her individual situation, he or she is encouraged to consult with the professional advisor of his or her choosing, including a tax advisor and or attorney. retirement planning services offered through Allworth Financial, a SEC-registered investment advisor. Securities offered through AW Securities, a registered broker-dealer, member of FINRA/SIPC. You can visit them at their website, and that is allworthfinancial.com, or you can call them by telephone, and that number is 513-469-7500. That's 513-469-7500. Our next article is titled, Prime Energy Sports Drinks Contain PFAS and Excessive Caffeine, Class Action Suit Says. And that's by Jonathan Limehouse of the Cincinnati Inquirer. YouTubers Logan Paul and KSI founded Prime Hydration in 2022, and while their products have become increasingly popular and profitable, the company continues to face class action suits over the ingredients of their energy and sports drinks. Prime Hydration LLC was sued April 8 in Southern District of New York over misleading and deceptive practices regarding the company's 12-ounce energy drinks containing between 215 and 225 milligrams of caffeine as opposed to the advertised 200 milligrams, according to the class action suit. Lara Vera of Poughkeepsie, New York, resident, filed a suit in federal court on behalf of herself and others who bought Prime products across the U.S. The complaint says Vera purchased Prime's blue raspberry products several times in August of 2022. For about $3 to $4 each, but she would have never bought the drinks if she had known the actual caffeine content, according to the suit. Vera's suit is seeking $5 million from the company owned by Paul and KSI, real name Olajide Olayinka Williams, J.J. Olatunji, court records show. Court records do not say whether Prime Hydration retained legal counsel for Vera's suit. How much caffeine is in the Prime Energy drinks? Prime's advertised 200 milligrams of caffeine is equivalent to half a dozen Coke cans or nearly two 12-ounce Red Bulls, Vera's class action suit says. A 12-ounce can of Red Bull energy drink contains 114 milligrams of caffeine, and a cup of coffee contains 100 milligrams of caffeine, according to the suit. The suit continues to say that there is no proven safe dose of caffeine for children. Side effects of kids consuming caffeine could include rapid or irregular heartbeats, headaches, seizures, shaking, upset stomach, and adverse emotional effects on mental health, according to the complaint. Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, called on the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, to investigate Prime energy drinks in 2023 because of dangerously high caffeine levels. Schumer alleged in a letter to the FDA that vague marketing targeting young people influenced parents to buy a cauldron of caffeine for their kids. Schumer's call to action to the FDA is referenced in Vera's suit. USA Today contacted Prime Hydration attorneys Tuesday afternoon, but did not receive an immediate response. What are the Prime Hydration lawsuits? Vera's legal battle is beginning, but Prime is still dealing with another class action suit from 2023 alleging a flavor of the company's sports drinks contain PFAS or forever chemicals. Independent third-party testing determined the presence of PFAS chemicals in Prime Hydration grape flavor, according to a class action suit filed August 2nd, 2023, in the Northern District of California by the Milberg Law Firm on behalf of Elizabeth Castillo and others similarly affected. Lead plaintiff Elizabeth Castillo, a resident of California, purchased Prime Hydration on multiple occasions but says she would not have bought it at all if the product had been accurately marketed and labeled as containing PFAS. The Milberg Law Firm said in an August 23 news release, these chemicals were not reasonably detectable to consumers like herself. Castillo's suit is seeking $5 million in judgment, court records show. As of April 18, the judge in the case has heard Prime's argument to dismiss the suit due to Castillo not alleging a recognizable injury and her not alleging facts showing a concrete and imminent threat of future harm, according to the drink company's motion. What are forever chemicals? PFAS are called forever chemicals because they bioaccumulate or accrue in the body over time, the Milberg Law said in its news release. These man-made chemicals are well studied and have been found to have adverse effects on the human body and environment, the New York City headquartered law firm said. Many PFAS are found in people's and animals' bloods and can be detected at low levels in a variety of food products and in the environment, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, said. Forever chemicals can be found in water, air, fish, and soil at locations across the nation and the globe, according to the EPA. There are thousands of PFAS chemicals, and they are found in many different consumer, commercial, and industrial products, the EPA said. This makes it challenging to study and assess the potential human health and environmental risk. Who made Prime Energy Drinks? Before founding Prime Hydration LLC, Logan Paul, 29, and KSI, 30, were YouTubers who turned their millions of subscribers into supporters of their boxing, wrestling, music, social media content, and other endeavors. Going into the drinks business proved to be profitable for both YouTubers, as Prime Hydration generated more than $250 million in retail sales in its first year, including $45 million in a single month, according to the Milberg Law Firm. Paul and KSI continue to keep Prime products in the spotlight, whether it is paying for an ad during Super Bowl 57, having live streamer iShow Speed dress up in a Prime sports drink bottle during the WrestleMania 40, or signing athletes including Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Judge, Israel Adesanya, Tyreek Hill, Kyle Larson, Alicia Lehman, and others to sponsorship deals. Our next article is titled, Kroger and Albertsons Agree to Sell Off 579 Stores in Bid to Save Merger, and that's by Alexander Coolidge of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Kroger and Albertsons announced Monday they've agreed to sell off 579 stores to Piggly Wiggly operator CS Wholesale Grocers as part of their $25 billion proposal to merge, a bigger divestiture than previously announced. In the fall of 2023, Kroger and Albertsons agreed to divest 413 stores to the Keene, New Hampshire-based wholesaler and retailer in order to mollify regulators' concerns over maintaining competition. This year, regulators, including the Federal Trade Commission, sued to stop the deal. They claimed the merger would hurt competition, even with the divestitures. Citing regulators' concerns, Kroger and Albertsons announced they were adding 166 extra stores to the previous divestiture plan. The value of the store sale also climbed from $1.9 billion to $2.9 billion to be paid to Kroger after the merger. The original deal with CS included a clause that noted it might be expanded in the future to win regulatory approval. We have reached an agreement with CNS for an updated divestiture package that addresses concerns raised by regulators and will further ensure that CNS can successfully operate the divested stores as they are operated today, Kroger CEO Rodney McMullen said in a statement. Kroger's announcement reiterated previous assurances that no stores would close or frontline employees would lose their jobs or their union contracts. It also repeated the company's pledge to lower prices after the merger. Our next article is titled, Cincinnati and NKY Joann Stores Will Remain Open After Company Files for Bankruptcy. And that's by Amanda Garrett of the Akron Beacon Journal. About 6 weeks after filing for bankruptcy, Joann Inc. Thursday afternoon said in a federal judge has approved its plan to reorganize, remain in business, and operate as a private company. Joann expects to successfully complete its financial restructuring and emerge from the court-supervised process in the coming days, the company said in a press release issued from its Hudson, Ohio headquarters. The company has said all along it hoped the bankruptcy would allow it to reduce its debt by over $500 million while keeping its more than 800 stores open and fully operational. Joann operates several stores in Greater Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky. Thursday's announcement said the company will preserve the jobs of its more than 18,000 team members as part of the Chapter 11 bankruptcy restructuring. Chris DiTullio, Chief Customer Officer and co-lead of the interim office of the CEO, called the restructuring a significant milestone. We could not have reached this point without the unwavering dedication of our team members, the continued support of our industry partners and landlords, and the tremendous loyalty and enthusiasm of our customers, he said in a release. Scott Skakila, the company's CFO, and other co-lead of the interim office of the CEO, added that the company was grateful to financial and industry stakeholders who enabled Joann to keep operating in recent weeks. Those stakeholders, which Joann did not name, will now own and operate the company as a private entity. With a strengthened balance sheet and improved liquidity, we are better positioned to work collaboratively with our vendors, business partners, and landlords, and ultimately to inspire the creativity in our customers that helps them find their happy place, Sakala said in a release. Our next article is titled, Popular Brunch Spot, Sleepy Bee Cafe to Shut Down College Hill Location. That's by B.B. Hodges of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Editors note, this story has been updated to clarify the Sleepy Bee Cafe's comments on the reason behind the closure. Sleepy Bee Cafe will close one of its four locations this month. The popular brunch spot announced on Facebook it will close its College Hill location after the venue's last day on Sunday, April 28. From the start, the College Hill location allowed us to embrace community engagements and partnership, especially with the local Aiken High School, the restaurant wrote on Facebook on Friday. The moths on the walls of the restaurant are courtesy of Aiken students. Food scraps are collected and composted at Aiken's robust agricultural program. And Julie Sutherland, College Hill general manager, created the inclusive cafe at Sleepy Bee, a 10-week immersive work experience in partnership with Project Life at Aitken. It is with sad and many fond memories that we say goodbye to the College Hill community, who welcomed us warmly and with open arms, The Post read, Sleepy Bee College Hill, which opened its doors in August of 2022, said in a Facebook comment that the main reason for the closure was that our breakfast and lunch operation isn't the best fit there. The cafe added that the Busy Bee team is working with the College Hill Community Urban Redevelopment Corporation to secure a new restaurant tenant as soon as possible, who will be able to offer dinner service. And that concludes the reading of the business section of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Sunday, April 28, 2024. My name is Haru. This is Radio Reading Services. Until next time, be safe, stay positive, and continue taking care of yourselves and each other. Now stay tuned for the opinions and editorials.
Hello, everyone. This is Dave, and I'll be reading editorial opinions out of the forum section of the Cincinnati Enquirer for Sunday, April 28th. Time permitting, I'll be reading these editorials. We need to listen to NPR's Yuri Berliner. This is written by Burl Love, who is the editor of the Enquirer. A Democratic problem. All of Ohio will lose if Joe Biden is kept off the Ohio ballot by the GOP. This is written by Columbus Dispatch opinion and engagement editor Amelia Robinson. Inaction on railroad safety plays with lives. This is written by Werner Lang, who's a guest columnist. Greg Landsman has gotten a lot done during his first term in office. This is written by guest columnist Steve Phelan. And When History Repeats, guest columnist David Hoffman. Again, those editorials will be read, time permitting. Here's our first editorial. We need to listen to NPR's Yuri Berliner. This is written by the Enquirer editor Burl Love. Andy Warhol predicted everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. For former NPR staffer Yuri Berliner, the spotlight burned hot for more than a week. The reverberations in newsrooms across the country, I predict, will last a lot longer. For those unfamiliar with Berliner, he was a senior business editor of the National Public Radio. In an April 9th essay published in the Free Press, he criticized NPR for losing its way during the Trump presidency, blaming a lack of viewpoint diversity and an increasing lean toward advocacy journalism. As examples, he cited the network's reporting on Trump's ties to Russia, which he deemed unbalanced, and said NPR initially treated the discovery of Hunter Biden's laptop as a distraction. An open-minded spirit no longer exists within NPR, and now, predictably, we do not have an audience that reflects America, Berliner wrote. NPR's critics and a host of conservative pundits celebrated Berliner as a whistleblower. On his Truth Social platform, former President Donald Trump called NPR, quote, a liberal disinformation machine, and demanded the government pull its funding. NPR went into full damage control mode. Quote, Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep took to his sidetrack and wrote what amounted to a line-by-line rebuttal offering a master's class in impeaching a witness. 8 days later, Berliner resigned, ending his 25-year career at NPR. As a journalist who spent 5 years working for another Washington-based national news outlet, USA Today, and one who often writes in this publication about the need for the press to rebuild trust, I'd like to share some thoughts on Berliner's essay and the aftermath. But first, some disclaimers. My opinions are my own, based on my experiences. I do not speak for my employer or my colleagues, past or present. Also, I serve on the board of Cincinnati Public Radio, which airs NPR programming locally. And finally, this is a complicated and nuanced topic for me to cover in a 900-word column. Berliner's essay was 3,500 words for comparison. I encourage you to read Berliner's piece in its entirety, along with Inkeep's response and the letter from NPR President and CEO Catherine Mehar to all staff, which was published on NPR's website. With that out of the way, Berliner's essay certainly can be picked apart, but it should not be dismissed. Its overarching clarion call rang true for me, reminding me of the times when the political polarization of our country was uncomfortably seeped into the newsrooms I've worked in. At USA Today, I was one of the editors who oversaw a report in 2016 that analyzed Donald Trump's involvement in more than 3,500 lawsuits over three decades, an unprecedented number for a presidential candidate. One high-ranking editor, who's no longer with the organization, took things a step too far, in my opinion, when she said in a planning meeting that she hoped the story would derail Trump's campaign. She, of course, was entitled to her political viewpoint, but those of us who chose this profession must put personal convictions aside and present the facts without judgment, which ultimately the story did, a testimony to the professionalism of the reporters who did the heavy lifting and worked to present a balanced report. But the, quote, unspoken consensus that Berliner described in NPR can easily take over a newsroom if left unchallenged. My concern with Berliner's essay is that it leads the reader to believe that the introspection he calls for is not happening at NPR. Based on the response from Mayer and NPR staffers, I know personally it has been, and I can vouch that it's happening in the company that employs me as well. In 2021, the Inquirer participated in an effort called Re-Engaging the Right, during which hundreds of conservative news consumers were interviewed so we could better understand perceptions of bias and how to restore trust. We learned a lot and hope it's evident in our political reporting today. But we're not perfect, and I always appreciate it when readers take the time to point out where we've fallen short. One of my takeaways from the Re-Engaging the Right feedback was that national news organizations often fail the sniff test when accused of promoting an agenda. Here's an exercise you can try to illustrate the point. Go to npr.org and search, quote, immigrant. When I did so this past week, the first story that came up was about a proposal in Massachusetts to allow migrants to work legally, regardless of their immigration status. The rest of the search results could be described as sympathetic to migrants. Do the same at foxnews.com. The top result when I searched was a story about an illegal immigrant charged with a sex crime in Connecticut, and the next five items were also crime stories involving immigrants. Try this exercise with other politicized search terms, and you'll see a similar pattern. Viewed individually, the stories are factual and stand up to review, but taken as a whole, it's obvious which way each news source leans politically, and that's a problem. It's too soon to arrive at a final thought on the Berliner dust-up, but one thing is clear. NPR and other news organizations should resist the urge to circle the wagons and err on the side of listening. There are lessons to be learned. This editorial is written by Inquirer Executive Editor Burl Love, who writes a biweekly column that takes you behind the scenes of the Inquirer. Occasionally, he shares his thoughts on local issues, particularly as they pertain to a free press and open government. Mr. Love serves as regional editor for the USA Today network in Ohio. He can be emailed at blove@inquirer.com. That's all lowercase. Today's second editorial is entitled A Democratic Problem. All of Ohio will lose if GOP keeps Joe Biden off the November ballot. This editorial is written by the Columbus Dispatch opinion and engagement editor, Amelia Robinson. There's no doubt that the Democratic Party blundered big time. It should have managed its calendar to ensure the Democratic National Convention would be convened in time to ensure its presumptive candidate, President Joe Biden, was nominated in time to make the ballot in Ohio and all other states. The timeline was clear. Ohio law requires certification on the ballot 90 days before an election. August 7th this year, Biden will not be officially nominated until the Democratic National Convention on August 19th in Chicago. Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose's office raised the error in an April 5th letter to the Ohio Democratic Party Chair Liz Walters, warning that Biden is at risk of not making the November 5th ballot. Ohio officials on April 16th soundly rejected a Democratic plan to professionally certify Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris ahead of the August 7th deadline. Quote, "No alternative process is permitted," by Julie M. Pfeiffer, a staff lawyer in Ohio Attorney General offices, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost's office, told LaRose's office, according to a report by the USA Today Ohio Bureau, which serves the Columbus Dispatch and other newspapers. Asked about the issue a week earlier, Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman, a Republican from Lima, made it clear that he did not mind twisting the sword. "I think it's a Democratic problem," he told reporters. Why? Matt Huffman is wrong. The Democrats screwed up. But this is not a Democratic problem. It is a Democratic problem that should be fixed and has been fixed here in past elections. A similar problem is happening in Alabama. Republicans there are working with Democrats to find a solution. Quote, "I'd like to think if the shoe was on the other foot, this would be taken care of," Alabama State Senator Sam Given, a Republican, told the state's AL.com. Ohio has temporarily changed the deadline in the past. It is done to accommodate both the 2020 Republican and Democratic conventions that saw the nominations of then-President Trump and Biden. Before that, it was done in 2012, conventions that saw the parties nominate Mitt Romney and then-President Barack Obama. If democracy were a game, it would be perfectly fine for Ohio Republicans to take this as a crushing victory and leave Democrats on the field embarrassed and shaking. If Biden's name does not appear on the November ballot, a price will be paid by nearly 500,000 Ohioans who voted for the virtually unopposed Biden in the March primary and the millions who anticipate voting for him in November. Those voters will not be the only losers, as they've done with gerrymandering and last year's failed August special election for constitutional amendment changes. Ohio GOP leaders will show that they see fair elections as hindrances and not goals. Playing democracy like a game could come with consequences. Such dirty tactics are not only morally wrong, they are unlikely necessary to secure Donald Trump's victory in Ohio. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee won Ohio in 2016 and 2020 by more than 8%. There is a good chance he will win big again this year. Making the Democrats' gaffe a them problem instead of an us problem will not only be a major embarrassment to Ohio, but it may backfire on Republicans. Some cringy gamesmanship, no doubt, energized typically unmotivated Democrats to turn out for the special election last August. Not having Biden's name on the ballot may keep Republicans from showing up on Election Day, believing Trump is running unopposed, which would help U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown and other down-ticket candidates. This issue is not unprecedented. In 2020, both the Republican and Democratic parties ran into candidate certification issues in Oklahoma, Illinois, Washington, and Montana, according to reporting by USA Today Ohio Bureau. The same issue came up in Alabama and Washington this year, but solutions to allow Biden on ballots are likely in those states. Washington Secretary of State, who is a Democrat, is expected to accept a provisional certification, the Seattle Times reported. On Wednesday, Alabama House and Senate committees approved bills to change the deadline to allow Biden on the November ballot, according to AL.com. What if the shoe was not on the Democrats' foot? The shoe could very well have been on the Republicans' foot this year, meaning Trump's name was not on the ballot. It would be wrong to disenfranchise Republican voters, just as it is wrong to disenfranchise Democrats. It would be a Democratic problem as it is now. We'd expect the Democratic Party to work on a fix to get the Republican candidate on the ballot. The reason is simple. This is not about the names on the ballot. It's all about Ohio voters. This is written by Columbus Dispatch opinion and editorial editor Amelia Robinson. She writes this editorial on behalf of the USA Today Network, Ohio. Next up, inaction on railroad safety plays with lives. This is written by guest columnist Lange. A train derailment, thankfully not a disastrous one like in East Palestine, hit Wyoming and Lackland on the evening of April the 20th. Yet, that averted disaster could still happen unless folks, especially clueless and or compromised politicians, wake up soon, very soon, and finally enact stringent safety measures for America's railroads. In the aftermath of the East Palestine catastrophe, U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, along with Senator J.D. Vance and two U.S. senators from Pennsylvania, introduced the Rail Safety Act on March the 1st, 2023. Since then, this bill, as well as its companion in the U.S. House, House Resolution 1674, has been forcibly placed in a corporate lobbyist-induced coma. Both bills remain stuck in a congressional quagmire. Behind the roaring silence in Congress regarding railroad safety lurks a host of corporate lobbyists more concerned with corporate wealth than with public safety and health. Foremost among this gang in the suites is Cook Industries, which spent nearly $8 million in the past year alone lobbying Congress against railroad safety legislation, according to lobbying disclosure forms from the Office of the Clerk of the House of Representatives. Consequently, only 12 senators co-sponsor the Railroad Safety Act, and only 17 House members, none of which are from Ohio, save for Representative Marcy Kaptur, are listed as co-sponsors of House Resolution 1674. A vapid alternative to the Railroad Safety Act is the Rail Act, parenthetically, Reducing Accidents in Locomotives Act, which was introduced by former Representative Bill Johnson on March the 12th, 2023, and now has the stated support of the entire Ohio congressional delegation, except for these representatives, Warren Davidson, Jim Jordan, Bob Latta, and Brad Winstrup. Failure to support Rail Safety Act, RAIL Act, is infuriating. The abject failure of Davidson's support to either the Rail Safety Act or the RAIL Act is particularly ironic and infuriating. Wyoming and Lackland are communities he purports to represent. But it was only by some miracle that the derailed rail car, an antiquated one, reportedly filled with isoprene, a carcinogenic, flammable, volatile organic compound, did not explode and release poisonous gases throughout our area. Congressional inaction on railroad safety is playing with the lives of Ohioans and all Americans. The last meaningful action on Senator Brown's Rail Safety Act came in May of last year when Senator Vance joined other senators in modifying it with, quote, an amendment in the nature of a substitute. The innocuous-sounding amendment in reality altered the original legislation and replaced it, among other deleterious provisions, with one no longer calling for a timely replacement of dangerous puncture susceptible tank cars with new high-quality ones. Even if Rail Safety Act passes, it is woefully insufficient. Based on a Department of Transportation directive adopted in 2015, older 1960s-era tank cars, as Department of Transportation 111 cars, need to be retrofitted or replaced with a much-improved design of DOT 117 cars by May of 2025. This phase-out timeline was echoed in the original version of the Rail Safety Act, but was changed in the Vance version to December 2027 or possibly later, a shift major corporations like Dow, DuPont, and 3M warmly greeted. Unfortunately, this means that even if and when the Rail Safety Act is passed, communities throughout America will still be threatened for years by probable catastrophic derailments of antiquated tank cars carrying hazardous materials through heavily populated areas. As necessary as passage of the Rail Safety Act is, even in its diluted form, it is woefully insufficient. What is desperately needed is something well beyond begging or even demanding railroad owners and operators change their behavior and policies, endangering the public. Something that our wise forebears had done with great success over a century ago when we saw a nationalization of America's railroad industry. Public ownership of railroads is the fast express to a public safety, and it is long overdue. This editorial is written by Warner Lang, who lives in Wyoming. Our fourth editorial is Greg Landsman has gotten a lot done during his first term in Congress. This editorial is written by guest columnist Steve Phelan. I read with interest a recent guest opinion by Bill Laverty on Congressman Greg Landsman. Parenthetically, quote, Landsman's support of border policies has been harmful to the people of Cincinnati, which is in the April 7th edition. One of the most striking parts was the insinuation that Landsman, who's a Democrat, is a rare national figure who stood up to his party on the issue of border security. In fact, Landsman has been a leader of the bipartisan border fix, among other big issues that we face today. Thankfully, Landsman was also part of a bipartisan group in Congress that got the budget passed, protecting critical investments in our communities and families, and voted to pass the critical national safety and global and investment bills. In his first term, Landsman visited El Paso and saw firsthand the issues at the southern border. He's led on bipartisan border fix, the first real substantive effort in Congress to tackle this issue in decades. The legislation would dramatically increase Border Patrol agents and immigration judges. With the new judges, the asylum process will go from years to months. This plus asylum reform and the ability to shut down the border when it's overwhelmed would make a huge difference. Landsman has also spoken out about the need to add additional pathways, such as expanding work permits, to ensure the asylum process is protected for people fleeing for their lives. This is the kind of common sense we need in Congress. Landsman is pragmatic on this issue and others. His Republican opponent, Orlando Sanza, has taken an extreme position on the border like he has on so many issues. He wants to take away support for children who arrive at the border. He would join the far right in not just pushing for some of the most extreme policies, such as mass deportation. he would most certainly be a part of the group in Congress who are blocking a bipartisan border fix because they want it to remain a political issue. Sanza has already committed to a national abortion ban and national gay marriage ban. He also wants to make it easier for young people and criminals to get guns. Landsman's first bill in Congress was to cap the cost of insulin for children. He's introduced several bipartisan bills to increase public safety for helping local police and fire departments with recruitment and retention. He has also introduced a bill to help lower prescription drug prices for seniors on Medicare and pushed prioritizing hiring veterans in federal jobs. He's been one of the most outspoken voices in Congress on lowering the cost of child care and has helped bring millions of dollars back to Southwest Ohio. And Landsman has been accessible, holding frequent town halls all across the district and bringing federal officials to the region to highlight our priorities and focus attention on our needs. Landsman has gotten more done in one term than many have in their entire careers in Congress. Steve Phelan is a retired marketer and former Republican who lives in Anderson Township. Our final editorial today is entitled When History Repeats. It's written by guest columnist David Huffman. One common argument against the teaching of history is that it's a waste of time, and given that history is often taught as a rote recitation of events that will never return, this argument might have some merit. But just because there will never again be a First or Second World War doesn't mean there will not be a World War III. Just because America once threw off the shackles of a crazed monarchy doesn't mean it is exempt from embracing a new equally crazed monarch in the future. And just because the inequities and injustices sired by the de jure Jim Crow segregation laws are relics of the past does not mean that similar inequities and injustices sired by de facto segregation will not appear in the future. History does repeat, and we are seeing evidence of this today. For example, after the Civil War, the Reconstruction era in the American South saw hopeful progress for former slaves, with several elected to both federal and state political offices. But it was not long before this process was viewed as a threat to white supremacy, which spawned a cycle of events that caused it to be largely undone. A similar type of progress was also erased after the death of George Floyd. For all too brief of a time, America experienced a, quote, mini reconstruction as businesses, entertainment, education, and even politics began to resuscitate long overdue discussions about the lingering effects of institutional and systemic racism, only to have it met with attacks on the teaching of African American history, affirmative action, diversity, equity, inclusion initiatives, parenthetically, DEI. These backlashes were not surprising, especially since throughout American history, the civil rights, liberties, and even the lives of African Americans have been treated as little more than poker chips to be self-servingly gambled by politicians seeking votes, financial gain, and or populist appeal from Andrew Johnson's canceling the assassinated Abraham Lincoln's plan to provide land to newly freed slaves, to Rutherford B. Hayes ending Reconstruction completely in order to win a disputed presidential election, thereby ushering in decades of Jim Crow segregation laws and racially motivated violence of political cartoonist Thomas Nast, who once described as, quote, worse than slavery. In addition, the federal courts were ostensibly created to protect the rights of racial, political, and religious minorities, instead issued the Dred Scott decision, which openly declared African Americans, quote, had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Ignored for decades, this 14th Amendment's intent to apply the Federal Bill of Rights to the states and in 1896, the case of Plessy v. Ferguson endorsed the doctrine of, quote, separate but equal, which made this same amendment's equal protection clause more illusory than real. Now, many right-wing politicians and judges are playing these poker chips again. The United States Supreme Court has significantly weakened the Voting Rights Act and all but eliminated affirmative action in higher education, a ruling that has, in turn, ignited a politically opportunistic backlash against DEI. And it should not be surprising that many of the states that have outlawed DEI were once slave-holding states and or had post-Civil War Jim Crow laws. Although these anti-DEI policies are disingenuously advertised as combating, quote, reverse discrimination, the truth is far more sinister. Federal politicians are, in reality, hoping to reduce the economic and political power of African Americans, while state politicians are hoping that these policies will drive current African-American residents away and dissuade others from moving there by making them inhospitable places to work and live. It's time to recognize that the chaotic propaganda that eliminating affirmative action and DEI initiatives will somehow bring about a society where people will be judged by their achievements instead of their race, gender, political connections, religion, quote, parenthetically, or lack thereof, sexual orientation, and or gender identity, is like believing that, quote, separate but equal was actually going to work out that way. This editorial is written by David R. Hoffman. He is a retired civil rights and constitutional law attorney who lives in South Bend, Indiana. That will be today's last editorial as our time's run out. I'll be back next week with more from the editorial opinions of the forum section of the Cincinnati Inquirer. This is Dave. We'll talk to you next week.